Graham Summers, President and Chief Market Strategist for Phoenix Capital Research. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Great to be here again. Nice to see you, Tom.
Nice to see you too, Graham. Of course, the last time you and I spoke, we were kind of talking all about the Fed, how Trump is, you know, in a way trying to take over control of the Fed.
Yes.
And we're going to dig into all of that, but let's start with kind of dissecting what the most important pieces are about the current state of the Fed under Powell.
Sure. So the Powell Fed has a lot of people defending it publicly, but these are people that typically seem to just think if it's coming from Trump, it's bad, and anything that's not from him is good. And the reality is the Powell Fed is a very complicated Fed. First and foremost, it's had numerous large scandals that kind of got swept under the rug. One of them was, it came out that multiple senior officials at the Fed were engaged in insider trading around Fed policy decisions during the pandemic. These were people who were trading based on their knowledge of what the Fed was about to do that no one else was privy to. And they were actually making millions of dollars doing this. They resigned, but nobody went to jail. Nobody had to give back the money they earned. We're talking about people committing major felonies and nothing came of it. And another thing I would add is anyone who thinks that those presidents were the only people doing that are very misguided. I would imagine they had family members and buddies that they were sharing that information with too. Another thing that happened under Powell was we saw a really dramatic shift in focus from, you know, historically the Fed's focus is supposed to be the economy and just the economy, specifically inflation and employment. And their goal is to maximize employment while trying to keep inflation at bay. And during the Powell years, specifically under the Biden administration, there were multiple times where the Powell Fed was starting to proclaim an increased focus on things like climate change, racial discrimination, and inconsistencies in incomes amongst different races, various things that you would probably describe nowadays as being, quote, woke or left-leaning in political perspective. And while those views, I mean, I'm not a political strategist, so it's not my place to comment on those, you know, those views may be valid, but as far as the Fed's concerned, it has nothing to do with what the Fed's supposed to be doing. The Fed's supposed to be completely politically neutral. It's supposed to specifically just focus on the economy. To put this in perspective for anyone who says, well, that means Graham doesn't care about, you know, race or climate. You know, imagine if the Department of Justice came out and suddenly announced that they were going to look into justice based on interest rates or justice based on GDP. People would say, what the heck's that got to do with what they're supposed to be doing? That's like what the Fed was doing. And then finally, and I think most egregiously, Jerome Powell himself was one of the main proponents of the view that inflation was non-existent and then that it was transitory in late 2020, early 2021. And then after pushing this myth, I mean, everyone saw what was happening. It was very obvious inflation had entered the financial system. In fact, the Fed's own research was telling us. The Fed puts out a piece called the Beige Book, which consists of the 12 different branches of the Fed and its officials doing sort of outreach to captains of industry, people in the real economy. And multiple times, starting, I believe, April of 2021, all of the Beige Book details were showing that companies were saying inflation's present, our costs are rising, we're going to have to raise prices. End of story. So the Fed was fully aware that inflation was real, but Powell was pushing this narrative that it was transitory, that it was kind of a year-over-year effect, not an actual real phenomenon. And then strangely, President Biden nominated him for a second term, and within a week of that happening, he completely abandoned the entire narrative that inflation was transitory. So that's particularly egregious. You know, it's one thing to engage in political games. It's another to turn a blind eye to people you're managing who are committing felonies. But it's something else entirely to sort of play games with inflation, which is something that dramatically affects Americans and their pocketbooks. And then to do that for what appears to be careerism, specifically playing, you know, towing the line with the express intent of trying to get nominated to be Fed chair again. And then once you get that, abandoning that entire perspective. So the Powell Fed has been very controversial to anyone paying attention. President Trump came in and won the election in 2024 and immediately set about attacking the Fed, specifically for this idea that the Fed is not politically neutral, that it plays political games. Regardless of whether you like President Trump or not, the fact that he's the messenger doesn't mean that the message is false. I would be inclined to agree that the Fed under Powell has committed multiple kind of deviations from what its focus should be. And so to that end, the president just decided to play hardball and start pressuring them to aggressively cut rates. And to that end, he's essentially had various people under him, specifically Pulte at the Federal Housing Association, or whatever it's called, I forget the acronym at the moment, finding out that there are these Fed officials who are still committing crimes. Specifically, Lisa Cook got caught committing mortgage fraud. Again, whether you like President Trump or not is irrelevant. If Lisa Cook claims that her residence is primary and it's actually an income property, and she did that to get a lower interest rate, that's mortgage fraud. And she got caught doing that. So the president fired her and she refused to resign. And then Jerome Powell, who's her superior, refused to force her to resign. Well, you know, regardless of your opinions of President Trump, I think we're all fully aware he's someone who likes fighting. He's perfectly willing to get dirty. He's perfectly willing to punch back. So Jerome Powell sort of played this game of play stupid games, win stupid prizes with Trump. I mean, it's one thing to try that with a character like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. If you're going to get into a pissing match with Donald Trump, don't act surprised if he does something absolutely bananas and says that you should quit your job. And then if you refuse to, has the Department of Justice start investigating you? So the reality is, whether or not you like President Trump, regardless of whether you like Jerome Powell, these are just facts. People committed crimes, and Jerome Powell didn't force them to resign. And the latest version of it was simply that the Fed is currently renovating its headquarters, and the headquarters are about 26,000, excuse me, 260,000 square feet, and they're spending $3 billion doing this. To put that in perspective, a brand new NFL stadium costs the same amount, and that is usually 3 million square feet, and it's a brand new structure. It's not renovations. So President Trump has essentially used this as an excuse to go after the Fed, saying, "This is outrageous. Why are they spending all this money?" And unfortunately for Jerome Powell, he happened to lie about some of the details of the plan under oath to Congress. And so President Trump is using that as the excuse to try to force Powell out.
You know, all of this is kind of ironic considering that Powell was Trump's actual pick, right?
Yes, I
In
agree.
2016.
One of the strangest things about President Trump is that, you know, when he first announced he was running for office, a lot of people were saying that we were going to see a private sector president, someone who was good at hiring people, someone who was going to put key players in positions of power. And in point of fact, much of his choices have been disastrous. He seems to always want to pick people who are completely opposed, if not antithetical, to his own views of what he wants to accomplish. So there's a lot of own goals that aren't really necessary that he keeps making. Powell's certainly one of them.
Graham, the last time we spoke, we were kind of discussing the idea that President Trump is making a move to basically control the Fed, having chosen basically four of out of the seven members of the Board of Governors.
Yes, that's right.
So since we did that interview, he has now picked the Fed chair, Kevin Warsh.
Yes.
Is this still the case that, you know, he's making this move, as you and I said last time, to basically try to control the Fed?
Yes, the reality is, you know, I actually studied President Trump quite a bit when he first announced his goal of being president, and then especially once he won the 2016 election. And the framework that guy uses for things is he prioritizes loyalty over anything else. Including qualifications and other things. Now, you know, that's why you get these weird job picks. What's even weirder, though, you know, the first term under President Trump, he's essentially using the same framework he used during his experience in commercial real estate, which was family business, tight inner circle, Go with what people tell you to do if you don't have expertise in it. And that's gotten him into a lot of problems because in his first term specifically, he had no political experience at the time. And so he surrounded himself with people who really didn't agree with what he was trying to accomplish, who would then recommend people for positions who were going to try and sabotage him. He seems to have learned from this quite a bit in his second term. You see this specifically with this transition team, but then you get this issue where you have people who are, obviously loyal to him, but they may not be the most qualified for what they're trying to do, which has raised a lot of eyebrows with Kevin Warsh, because Kevin Warsh actually historically has been very opposed to the Fed easing monetary conditions aggressively. He called quantitative easing kind of reverse Robin Hood. He said that the Fed shouldn't be a bunch of pampered princes who kind of do whatever they want. He was very against the Fed printing money when it's not necessary to do so, which is kind of bizarre because President Trump is now, raging that the Fed needs to be cutting rates. Our rates need to be the lowest in the world. We need to be printing money and engaged in quantitative easing. And then Kevin Warsh comes out and says, well, we're actually considering kind of merging the Treasury and the Fed into one entity, which would then put the Fed exclusively under the executive branch and at the whims of the president. So yeah, it definitely seems as though the Trump takeover of the Fed is going full steam ahead. Whether that's a good thing, I think, remains to be seen, but it's certainly the lay of the land at the moment.
Well, it's interesting with the last point that you mentioned before my last question there about him picking people that seem to be contrary to,
yes,
what his goal seemingly is. And, I've gone back and forth on this, trying to understand, let's say, the optics of presenting Warsh as being very hawkish when, between Besant and Trump, it seems that they want lower rates, lower dollar. So does this end up, floating the trial balloon of having of a more hawkish Fed president versus and then being able to say, hey, we really need this easing program considering this guy was a hawk and he thinks that we need to start easing? Do you think that optics or those optics really play into the situation?
That's a great question. The problem with politics is that it's a world where you can predict anything and then you're wrong and you have an explanation for why you're wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, that's why I like the markets so much more, because you've got the scoreboard of profits versus losses where you can say, well, I was right, money was made. Politics, that whole industry is full of people who've been wrong their entire careers, but they always have great explanations for why it doesn't pan out. So I'd kind of steer clear of getting too much into that. I just know from having studied Trump and his framework that loyalty is number one. I mean, we saw this. He makes these bizarre statements. Like, you look at the big tech CEOs. They all were obviously completely opposed to Trump and even helped sort of stop him from being elected in 2020 by suppressing various media stories. And then they turn around and say, okay, we'll give you $1 million for your inauguration. He's like, these guys are great guys. They're my buddies now. Like, we're all together. It's just like, is he really that easy to massage? Another one was, what was it? The situation with Gavin Newsom. Kevin Newsom clearly can't stand Trump, but then Trump says, he always compliments me. He's always a nice guy, so I like him. I don't get it. I don't know. But at the same time, and this is kind of important to note, because I try to always put my biases to the side. At the end of the day, Trump did commit the biggest political upset, arguably in history. And the guy has, won against all odds two presidencies. So, as much as I can criticize him or say this looks buffoonish or foolish, I mean, at the end of the day, he's done things that so few people have done. You have to wonder if there's a method to the madness. What that actual method is, I don't necessarily know. It's very clear he has, loyalty is number one. Trust is significant. It's very important that he wants people to kiss the ring. He's got a massive ego. He loves people telling him he's great, even if they secretly hate him. But then at the end of the day, you look at some of the deals he's lined up, and they're incredible deals. So obviously, he's very successful at some things. That's why I sometimes get baffled why people break the world down into sort of Trump good, not Trump great. I'm sorry, Trump bad, not Trump good. Because the reality is, whether you like him or not, some of the stuff he's doing, I think really is beneficial to the country, regardless of your political leaning. I mean, for certain, onshoring, I think, is something that benefits us because it, from a strategic perspective, it doesn't make sense for us to rely on China for 90% of our antibiotics. It just, that's, whether you like Trump or not, I don't see how that's a great thing. But obviously, a big problem for our world right now is everything's political. And also, oftentimes the message gets lost in delivery, and Trump's way of delivering things doesn't always rub people the right way. Let's put it that way.
That is true, Graham. My as I was, preparing this morning, I started thinking about the move, as we already talked about, to control the Fed. And if this is very strategic at this time as well for the Trump White House to have control because of what could happen in the midterms in November. You know, if the Democrats end up taking a big, chunk of the House and the Senate back, this could kind of hamstring the rest of, Trump's presidency. So is this a very strategic time as well to be able to have more control of more control or let's say more influence over monetary policy going forward for the next 2 years?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I agree completely. If you look at, you can say many things about the president, but he's obviously not a fool, at least not in the sense that most people think. The reality is, what are his biggest successes? They're things where he can do things unilaterally with total autonomy, like the situation with Venezuela. Regardless of whether you think that was a good thing or not, that's an astonishing accomplishment. I'm not saying, bear in mind, I'm not saying it's good, but you can get into a country, remove the leader, suffer zero casualties, and get out in 40 minutes. Like, that's especially when China's entire delegation was there the day before. That's just mind-boggling. And it's very clear that the president can accomplish these sorts of things when he doesn't have anyone who he's beholden to. But then you look at some of the other things where he tries to legislate, the judiciary gets in the way. He gets hamstrung in Congress, even by the GOP, where they don't appoint the people he wants in positions. So I think you're absolutely right. Trump sort of figured out that the lay of the land is, if he wants to accomplish anything, he's got to go routes where he doesn't have oversight. And stacking the Fed is one of those ways. Also, the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent's a very astute operator. That's, he's a very successful macro hedge fund manager. He's very, very astute about the way the financial system works. And I think what they're really trying to do is they figured out that politically it's impossible to rein in the spending. I mean, if you look at what happened, one of the biggest pivots for Trump was when he's on the campaign trail in 2024, it's, we're going to balance the budget. DOGE is going to cut spending. Tariffs are going to raise revenues. We're going to balance the budget. We're going to reduce the debt, et cetera. He gets into office. That lasts 60 days, essentially. They introduce the tariffs. The stock market melts down. Then the bond market starts revolting. And the bond market basically just broke the president. Not many people know this, but the overnight session between April 8th and April 9th, the bond market started acting in ways that you would consider unruly. And when bonds start getting unruly, bad, bad things can happen. And it was not coincidence that literally the next day, Trump announced the 90-day pause on the tariffs. That was the bond market and the financial system basically saying, if you want to proceed with this, you can, but you're risking a potential recession right here and now. And obviously, Trump backed down from that. And then, Elon Musk leaves DOGE. The Congress passes the big, beautiful bill, which, excuse me, increases spending by like 5 trillion. Whatever DOGE cuts they codified are a drop in the bucket compared to the spending. So I think what Trump and Bessent and his sort of inner circle have figured out is, politically, it's absolute suicide to try to actually balance the budget. So your best bet is run the economy hot, try to accomplish growth by any means possible, and in that sense, hopefully get the debt to GDP ratio to come down. Simultaneously, try to get the Fed to ease as aggressively as possible so you can try and lock in as much of the debt that's rolling over, because that's the other issue. About a quarter of the debt's coming due in the next 9 months. try and get interest rates as low as possible so that when that debt's rolled over, you can lock it in long term at the lowest rate possible. And then if that ignites inflation, deal with that down the road. I think it's a very strategic move. I think it's probably a pretty smart move given the alternative is to heck with it. Let's just cut all the spending and see what happens to the economy, which would cause a market crash. It started to with tariffs. And unfortunately, at this point, our economy is so K-shaped, where sort of the top 10% of consumers account for like 40 to 50% of consumer spending, which translates to roughly a third of GDP growth, that if you crash stocks or you crash housing, you're guaranteed a recession, maybe a depression in the near future, because the reality is so much of the economic growth is the wealth effect. It's people feeling wealthier, so they go out and spend even if they don't have the money. Meanwhile, everyone in the lower 90% is struggling because cost of livings haven't come down. And certainly cost of living is not, incomes are not rising commensurately in a way that allows people to maintain their standards of living. And so the economy has become very K-shaped. And we saw this with the tariffs. When the stock market collapsed like it did, it went down about 20% in 2.5 weeks. You look at everyone from Chipotle, Walmart, Southwest Airlines, PepsiCo, all came out and said consumer spending is retracting at the fastest pace since the pandemic. Turn things around, stocks go through the roof, suddenly people start spending money again, the economy stays afloat. So I think you're dead on. I think what Trump's doing with the Fed is completely strategic. I think it's probably the best play he's got with the hand he's been dealt. But obviously, there's going to be some nasty medicine to take down the road if this ignites another round of inflation, which I actually think it probably will, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, with the amount of debt outstanding and the amount of spending, I don't think, that the math doesn't math there.
No,
There's
it does
not
not.
really any palatable way out of that equation.
No, we never. The reality was COVID changed everything. I don't know. I mean, to get back to what's considered pre-normal, pre-COVID, you'd have to take some pretty nasty medicine in the financial system, and I don't think anyone has the will to do that. We're running a deficit that traditionally you'd see during a major recession at a time when the economy is still growing. Even though we've taken in almost $300 billion in tariff revenue, we're still running a deficit that's larger than it was the year before. I mean, it's crazy to say this, but the debt's actually increased as a higher percentage under Trump than it did under Biden, which is ironic because in nominal terms, it was the same amount, $8 trillion for both of them. But under Trump, $8 trillion, we went from whatever it was, 16 to 24. That's a larger percentage increase than we had with Biden, 24 to 32. So, and now we're at 40. So it's even, it's out of control. The debt's increased faster during the first year of Trump's presidency than it had under any year under Biden. So, I think that's just kind of, that's the choice they're taking. But interestingly enough, everyone seems to be doing that. You look at Japan, they've announced they're going to implement, fiscal aggression and just spend their way out of things. I imagine Europe's going to follow suit pretty soon as well.
So Graham, there's so many corners of the market that seem so very chaotic right now.
Yes.
Do you think that there is, let's say, a threat of an AI-induced depression around the corner? And is the Fed already intervening?
That's a great question. If you read what some of these AI executives are saying, they're saying that the head of Microsoft's AI department just came out and said in 12 to 18 months, he believes AI will be capable of doing everything from accounting to lawyer at a highly professional level. And so obviously the takeaway from that is like millions of people are losing their jobs. I don't know if that's necessarily correct. For one thing, you saw similar arguments during the internet. When the internet first came out, they were saying retail is going to disappear because why would anyone go to a store if they can buy it online? Travel agencies are going to disappear. Multiple industries just will cease to exist. Well, all those industries still exist now. It's just that you have people working hand in hand with technology in different ways. In fact, Goldman Sachs came out with some data that said something like 60% of the current jobs that exist now didn't even exist, I think, 50 years ago because of the way the economy was structured. So I'm less inclined to believe we're going to see some kind of jobs Armageddon. I think what's more likely to happen is just the economy dramatically shifts and you start creating new jobs of people who work with AI to try to get things to function in a way that is higher in productivity. And one reason I say that is, the people who are most critical of AI are actually experts. Because if you're just someone who doesn't know, you just have common knowledge, you're not an expert on, you're not a high-level attorney, high-level investment strategist, someone who has very expert levels of education or knowledge of something, you're inclined to put something into an LLM, a large language model, get an answer and think, oh, this is dead on. But if you read what some of these people are saying, like lawyers, surgeons, et cetera, they're saying, no, this is rife with hallucinations. This thing's saying stuff like it's fact and it's completely not real. You have to have an expert level of understanding to catch the mistakes AI is making. And that's actually the biggest debate that's going on behind closed doors at the big tech companies is, are they actually going to be able to achieve this kind of generalized intelligence, this kind of godlike intelligence that they suspect will be the case? Not many people know this, but the gentleman who actually ran Meta's AI division for years left because he and Zuckerberg had major disagreements about whether LLMs would ever actually be able to think like a person. That's kind of the jury's out on that one. My inclination, based on the way technology's revolutionized things, is that the economy keeps going on and just sort of shifts and people work with the technology in new ways. That doesn't mean that some jobs, obviously some jobs will cease to exist, but that's anytime a new technology comes in, that's the case. As far as the market is concerned with AI, I have very significant concerns because, since ChatGPT was introduced in November of 2023, AI stocks have accounted for 75% of market profits, 80% of, excuse me, 75% of market gains, 80% of market profits, and 95% of CapEx. And those plays are all struggling dramatically. The Mag 7 they're really haven't gone anywhere since September. And you look at what they're doing financially, these are the most profitable companies in history, and they're having to issue debt to maintain their CapEx. And they're also engaging in these big circular deals where, like, NVIDIA buys $100 billion worth of, gives $100 billion to OpenAI, and then OpenAI uses that money to go back and buy chips from NVIDIA. I mean, none of that's sustainable. So I'm concerned that the market's starting to figure out that this AI revolution we're in is not going to be linear, that the actual increase in productivity and success that it's going to bring isn't coming as soon as they think. And as a result, the market's probably going to suffer a kind of ridding of illusions that's going to be pretty painful for some people.
Well, as I was again considering that article and going through it, trying to figure out if, the Fed typically reacting too late, as it's always pointed to, I was, trying to consider that as part of their, let's say, their reaction to, getting ahead of this AI crash.
That's a great point, especially if you consider that stocks are now basically the economy. For decades, that was not the case. They are now specifically for that wealth effect I mentioned earlier, where, the one big thing, excuse me, the one big thing we've learned in the last 25 years, as far as central banks are concerned, is they can't create jobs and they can't boost incomes. All they can do is they can make credit cheaper, which can cause asset prices to rise, which makes people feel wealthier, which makes them go out and spend money. But in terms of actually generating jobs or boosting incomes, you can't. They can't do that because, I mean, we'll look at Japan. They've been doing ZERP since 1999 and QE since 2001, and they've been suffering deflation and long-term kind of secular stagnation. The big lesson we've learned over the last 3 decades with central banks is that they can't create jobs, they can't boost income. What they can do is they can make credit cheaper, which allows people to issue more debt, which allows leverage to stay in the system, and which typically induces asset prices, namely stocks and housing, to go up in value, which makes segments of the economy feel wealthier and more likely to go out and spend money, which keeps the economy chugging along. The reason I say that is if you look at Japan, they've been doing everything the Fed's been doing for an additional decade. The Fed introduced ZERP and quantitative easing in 2008. Japan introduced ZERP in 1999 and QE in 2001. Japan's had structural issues with its economy ever since. It's never had an economic boom. The best thing they ever saw was they announced a QE program equal to 25% of GDP in 2013, I think. And they saw a six-month major uptick in GDP. And then it rolled over and went right back to where it had been. And that's 25% of GDP. I mean, like a mind-boggling. It'd be like if the Fed announced, you know, an $8 trillion QE program. Just mind-blowing. So the reality is central banks, they can't create growth. The most they can do is just try to keep the system humming along in a way that people are willing to keep spending money.
You know, when we think about the AI boom that we've already seen, Graham,
yeah,
there's been a lot of money made from, you know, Nvidia and the AI related stocks.
Yes.
Do you think that is, you know, hitting its peak, or is the AI boom evolving into something different at this point?
Yeah, I actually think it's evolving very dramatically. In terms of the Mag 7, something I predicted. So if you simply just look at what they've done since September, they've essentially gone nowhere. You've also seen some interesting things happen where the companies that do really well, that report great results, quarterly results, they might get a brief pop, but then they reverse all of it. The latest example of that was Meta. They had a phenomenal fourth quarter of 2025. The stock went up like 8% overnight, and then within 48 hours, it had erased all those gains. That's a big tell. That means that pretty much everyone's all in on those stocks and there isn't much buying power anymore. And to that end, my view was that we were going to see a rotation take place. Specifically, you know, Mag 7 underperforms and the other 493 stocks in the S&P 500 do better. That's certainly been the case since Thanksgiving. The concern, though, is that if you want to talk strictly market structure, you know, Mag 7 accounts for like 35% of the S&P 500's weight. So if you don't have those stocks participating in a bull market, it's going to be very difficult for the bull market to be sustainable. That's exactly been the case. You're seeing things like consumer staples, industrials, and energy skyrocketing. But because they account for such a small weighting in the S&P 500, the market's kind of eking out these higher, you know, highs, but they're really, you know, you're getting a lot of pullbacks. You're starting to see things roll over. And if you look at like the momentum side of the AI trade, it's completely been obliterated. Things like Palantir are down, you know, 30% in the last 2 months alone. So the AI trade is definitely evolving. I actually suspect it's going to be a bit like the internet, where people forget, you know, it was the telecoms that built the internet. They spent like $1 trillion building out the infrastructure. But then it was Alphabet, formerly Google, and Meta, formerly Facebook, and Amazon that figured out how to make money from it. I can't help wondering if, in point of fact, you know, the Mag 7 are going to spend all these hundreds of billions building out the AI infrastructure, but the actual real winners, you know, the companies that really revolutionize things and make AI produce, you know, trillions in shareholder value, are actually going to be someone else.
Somebody that is actually able to monetize the use of AI.
Yeah, exactly. Someone who's going to actually be able to use AI to boost productivity and see financial returns skyrocket. Absolutely. If you look at some of the data about AI adoption, it's actually very early. You know, despite the fact this is all anyone talks about, I think only 50% of large companies have actually introduced it to how they produce goods and services. And it's even smaller. It's 7% for small companies. And of the companies that have, I think only 5% of them have actually seen a significant uptick in their financial returns, whether it's revenues or profits. So we're actually very, very early in AI. I know everyone thinks it's this thing that's just everywhere now, but in terms of actual adoption, where companies actually are using it in the day-to-day, adoption's very early. And I think potentially we're in a situation where we've gone way out over our skis in terms of where people think AI is going to end up. And we're going to potentially see some market dislocations, maybe a correction, possibly even a bear market. Because again, so much of this bull market's been driven by this idea that AI is going to change everything and it's going to do it, you know, right now. People forget, you know, investing is a timing situation. And if you say, well, this is going to happen in 12 months, and it actually takes 36 months, Well, those expectations adjusting means stocks really correct dramatically. And so I think it's quite possible we get into that situation. I actually am working on a note I'm going to be putting out to clients where I point to some historical precedents where you see structures happening in the markets like they are right now that lead to dislocations, potentially 10% corrections in stocks.
You know, you're talking about the idea of being early in the AI adoption curve, let's say. But it seems like one of the big stumbling blocks at this point with AI data centers and stuff is the actual energy generation for these data centers. So is that, you know, kind of part of that evolution of this AI trade?
Yeah, absolutely. So starting around second quarter, third quarter of 2025, I was putting out pieces saying, you know, the real beneficiaries from AI is going to be hard assets because all of this stuff takes tremendous amounts of copper, lithium, you know, cobalt, rare earths, all of this stuff. Tremendous amounts. I mean, just think about copper alone. Let's say a robot, I don't know, I think I read somewhere robots might require 25, 50 pounds of copper to make one. And Elon Musk is saying, well, we're going to make millions of these things. I mean, Robert Friedland's a legend in the mining industry. He's an Australian billionaire. He came out recently and said, people have no idea what's coming. We have to mine as much, you know, just to meet GDP growth, the 3%, we have to mine as much copper in the next 18 years as we have in the prior 10,000. I mean, and this is after, you know, years, if not decades, of this green energy, clean energy, you know, let's not sign off on mines. Let's not, you know, let's, everything's going to be solar. We don't need this stuff anymore. Well, apparently we really do. And in fact, we're going to need things we thought were like, you know, verboten, like uranium and nuclear energy to make this all work if you want it to work. And that's the other piece where the rubber meets the road. The reality is, the Trump administration has realized that AI is an arms race between the US and China. And whoever gets AI supremacy is going to have an undue amount of influence over the world. People, you know, let's play kind of a mental game, you know. You can think about the effect Google can have on people in terms of shifting perspective based on how they present search results. And we now know that they do. Imagine the effect you can have on if AI is just endemic in our financial system and our economy, where everything's controlled by AI, everything's automated, and the person who's got their finger on that button is nudging people a particular way. Unbelievable. So obviously, whoever, you know, between the US and China, whoever becomes AI supreme is going to have an exorbitant influence over how the world functions in terms of, you know, cultural differences, way people perceive things, reason, ways people are willing to sign off on certain policies. And to that end, the Trump administration is all in on trying to win this thing, which is part of the reason they're spending so much money when it doesn't make sense to do so. Because the alternative is China wins and China, the world shifts poles from the US to China as the superpower. And, you know, to that end, look at what they're doing. They're fast tracking domestic production of everything they can think of as far as mining is concerned. They've deemed 60 minerals critical to national security. They're, you know, actively investing in companies they think are vital to the production of AI, specifically, and you know, one of the big ones being Intel, because they've realized so many of our chips are coming from Taiwan, and that's potentially unviable long term. So another big reason why they're doing this run it hot thing is the AI trade, and that's where, you know, technology and hard assets are married, you know, because all of this requires hard assets to run. So I'm right there with you. I think we're going to see a situation where hard assets are actually outperforming paper assets dramatically. We've already seen that with gold, but I think you're going to start seeing it with things like copper, lithium, you know, cobalt, anything. Anything that's real and has to be pulled out of the earth that we haven't been, you know, producing domestically.
Yeah, the tangible side of supporting the AI or, you know, virtual side of the economy, it still needs to happen.
Yep, absolutely. So I think some of the biggest beneficiaries are going to be hard assets. And again, that's potentially inflationary because if you're throwing so much money at that trying to produce it, it's, you know, it's ultimately one way of thinking about things is we're kind of in a wartime economy right now. So, you know, we're it's just by any means possible, we have to make sure we win the AR arms race. And that's highly inflationary. Everything they're doing is inflationary. And I think gold's been showing you that. You look at what gold's done in the last year. You look at the fact that central banks are now buying gold. You look at the fact that even Wall Street's telling people to allocate to gold. You look at the fact that gold has broken out against every major world currency. This isn't just the dollar debasement. This is against the yen, the franc, the euro, the pound. I think the world's telling us that what's coming.
So, we've talked a little bit about gold already appreciating from a lot of this market volatility and these dislocations, particularly, let's say, in the dollar. But how do we think about gold and trade gold at these levels that really have never been seen before?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way I think about it is there are certain tectonic shifts that have taken place that signal that everything's different for gold this time. Typically when someone says, "Oh, it's different this time," you're supposed to run the other direction because it never is. It actually is for gold. What do I mean by that? Well, for the first time since the mid-90s, central banks are aggressively buying gold by 1,000 tons a year. They're buying so much of it that they now own more gold as a percentage of foreign reserves than they own treasuries. Again, hasn't been the case since the mid-90s. Wall Street is telling clients, and we can poke fun at Wall Street all you want, but at the end of the day, their clients have the deepest pockets in the world. They're the ones advising pension funds, large hedge funds, other financial institutions. They're coming out and saying you should do 60-20-20, 60% stocks, 20 bonds, 20 gold. Again, hasn't been the case for decades and decades. You're seeing gold getting attention from everyday people. For the longest time, gold was kind of, they called it whatever, a barbarous relic. And, there were people who were gold bugs, but they were usually considered conspiracy theorists or sort of fringe fanatics. Now everybody's looking at what gold's doing. You see lines of people around the world to buy gold. I mean, that's all telling us that this is a tectonic shift. This is a once in a lifetime shift. Now, having said that, so long term, it is different. But in the short term, when you get things going parabolic, like gold and silver did the last 12 months, especially the last 3 months, you're going to see tremendous volatility unfold. And that's what happened. We saw silver drop 35% in a day. Gold dropped, I think it was 12%. And when that happens, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about gold or specific stocks. When you get big one-day moves that slice off a major percentage of the gains, the market takes a while to digest that. You only really get V bottoms in stocks because you get interventions. You don't get interventions in gold. The powers that be don't want gold and silver going through the roof. They actually would prefer if they stayed lower. And you've seen this with the CME and other futures exchanges hiking margins to try to get, shake out some of the hot money. So the reality is gold and silver might be kind of dead for a while. A while might be 2 or 3 months, but the idea that they're going to sort of skyrocket and go straight back up to the all-time highs, if they did that, I'd be very worried that something was very, very wrong in the financial system. But that's specifically bullion. If you want to talk about the miners, the case is far more compelling because all of them are actually producing cash flows. And those cash flows are going to be significantly higher because everything in the last 3 months, in terms of production, provided you don't have a lot of hedges or fixed contracts, all of that's coming in at a much higher return because gold and silver are so much higher in price.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting, let's say, recognition by the market. And do you think that's what the market needs for the miners to draw more attention at this point?
I do. I think between that and some other situations, people always like the miners to a certain degree because they're very volatile, and a lot of volatility means the opportunity to make a lot of money fast. In fact, that's why everyone's loved AI, because a lot of these plays like Palantir, they're going, up double digits in a single day, or they were. But the gold miners, I think it's going to be much less kind of a lottery ticket and much more cash flow. It's going to be much more driven by fundamentals in ways you haven't seen for years. Certainly not since 2010, 2011, when we had the last sort of big peak in precious metals.
Excellent. Graham, I think that's a good place to kind of put a pin in it for today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we do?
Absolutely. I would say just really keep your sort of take off any blinders and try to see what the market's really telling you, as opposed to sort of buying into narratives. It's so easy to craft these stories that sort of explain things, but when you see situations like the Mag 7 haven't gone anywhere since September, when you see sort of credit default swaps for some of the Mag 7 or the, like companies like Oracle skyrocketing, that's the market telling you something's not going well here. Similarly with gold and silver, you don't get price moves like we do if things are stable. So I'm actually very nervous at the moment. Not nervous as in panicked, but just nervous as in concerned that things might come unhinged for a bit. I think long term, for the reasons we've expressed in this interview, stocks will likely do very well simply because it's now kind of a matter of national security. But that doesn't mean you can't see some hairy situations like what unfolded during the tariff tantrums.
Absolutely. For anybody that wants more of Graham's work, it's all available on Substack on his website, gainspainscapital.com, Graham Summers MBA on Substack, and as well as X, G Summers MBA. Graham, thanks so much for your time today. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. It was great to be here. I appreciate the conversation.